You simply keep your pretty mouth shut until she asks you a question. And if you have to leave the room for any reason, which you really shouldn't before she does, but if you feel the sudden urge to vomit, make sure to walk out of the room facing her. The Sultana must never see your ass, so you are never to turn your back on her. Understood?
Kitty nodded diligently. I understand. No talking, no vomiting, no ass backing.
Now, as I said, I don't want you to expect too much today. This is just an introduction and a chance for Her Majesty to become acquainted with you.
So you're saying she isn't going to give me a knighthood today?
Kitty, women don't get knighted in Malaysia. There is a whole different system of honors here. The Sultana can bestow a title whenever she pleases. But don't get your hopes up that it's going to happen today.
You sound angry at me, Kitty said with a little pout.
I'm not angry, Kitty. I'm just speaking over the chopper noise.
Truth be told, Oliver had been on the verge of a nervous breakdown ever since Kitty had delivered her ultimatum, and he was anxious for everything to go as planned today. He had way too much to lose if it didn't. Trying to placate her a bit, he continued.
I'm just trying to make you understand that these titles given by royals like the Sultana are real honors. They honor truly deserving people who have done a tremendous amount of good for Malaysia over a lifetime. People who build hospitals and schools, who start companies that support entire towns and provide work to thousands of locals. These honors mean a great deal more than Colette's title. All she ever did was spread her legs for some posh dimwit.
The helicopter swooped over the Kuala Lumpur skyline, passing the iconic Petronas Towers as it started to descend.
So this is where the Sultana lives?
Kitty asked as she peered out at the exclusive leafy neighborhood of Bukit Tunku.
This is just her little crash pad in KL for when she comes to the capital. She has residences all over the world. A house in Kensington Palace Gardens, a villa overlooking Lake Geneva, and of course the gigantic palace in Perawak.
Oliver informed her as the chopper touched down on the great lawn.
The two of them jumped out of the chopper, and a uniformed officer awaited them on the lawn. "Welcome to the Istana El Nor," he said as he led them toward a humongous white palace that resembled a wedding cake. Entering through the front doors, Oliver and Kitty found themselves in a vast reception hall with 9 gigantic pyramidal chandeliers that descended from the coffered gold leaf ceiling like upside-down versions of the Rockefeller Center Christmas tree.
"This is her little crash pad?" Kitty remarked.
"Oh, you have no idea, Kitty. Her home in Perawak is twice the size of Buckingham Palace."
They were shown into the drawing room, which had dramatic black marble floors and walls painted in a shimmering crimson hue. The space was filled with priceless Peranakan-gilded wood antiques, mixed with fantastical clawed Lalan bronze furniture. Facing them was a vibrant pink and yellow triptych of Andy Warhol paintings depicting the Dowager Sultana in her younger days.
"Wow, this was not what I was expecting," Kitty said,
clearly in awe of her surroundings. "Yes, the Dowager Sultana was definitely a hellraiser back in the 70s,
Oliver noted, as they both sat down on a backless velvet settee. Next to the settee was a round Lalan table laden with gold-framed photographs of the Sultana posing with famous personages. Kitty peered at the pictures, recognizing the Queen of England, Pope John Paul II, Barack and Michelle Obama, Indira Gandhi, and a woman with an enormous pile of blonde hair.
"Who is that blonde woman? She looks so familiar. Is she some queen?"
Kitty asked. Oliver squinted at the picture and then let out a quick laugh.
"No, but she is adored by many queens. That's Dolly Parton."
"Ah," Kitty said.
Suddenly, the double doors opened, and 2 honor guards in full dress uniform entered. Flanking the doorway, they kicked their heels at attention and tapped the base of their long bayonets on the marble floor twice in unison.
"We need to stand, Kitty," Oliver suggested.
Kitty quickly stood up, smoothing out the wrinkles on the front of her ankle-length Roxanda skirt and then adjusting her posture. The guard on the right side shouted sternly,
Sama sama, maju ke hadapan. Pandai cari pelajaran.
They tapped their bayonets on the floor again as the sultana swept into the room in a flaming violet silk kabaya, followed by four attendants. Her head was covered in a matching violet, blue, and white headscarf, and she resembled Queen Mary, covered in precious jewels from the waist up. Pinned in the middle of her hijab, right above her forehead, was an enormous sunburst diamond brooch with a 45-carat pink diamond in the center. On her ears were a pair of diamond and pearl girandole earrings, and around her neck were what appeared to be 10 or 12 heaping necklaces of nothing but diamonds, diamonds, and more diamonds. Kitty's jaw hung open at the sight of this queen mother ablaze in diamonds, and she dropped to a curtsy so deep Oliver thought she was doing the limbo. Oliver bowed smartly.
Oliver Sen, what a pleasure!
The pleasure is all mine, ma'am. May I humbly present Mrs. Kitty Bing of Shanghai, Los Angeles, and Singapore.
It's an honor to be in your beautiful country, Your Majesty, Kitty blurted out nervously, before remembering that she wasn't supposed to speak first.
The Dowager Sultana pursed her lips and stared at Kitty for a brief moment, saying nothing. She sat down on a throne-like bergère chair, and Oliver and Kitty took their seats again. An army of maids entered the room bearing gold lacquered platters filled with Malay desserts and steaming pots of tea. As the maids began serving tea to everyone, the Dowager Sultana smiled at Oliver.
Come, don't be shy. I know how much you love onde onde.
You know me too well, Oliver said, helping himself to one of the bright green rice cake balls stuffed with palm sugar and rolled in grated coconut.
Now, what brings you to this neck of the woods today?
Well, Kitty has recently become enchanted with Malaysia, so since we were in town, I thought it only fitting that she meet this country's greatest living legend.
The Dowager Sultana beamed.
Oh, Oliver, you make me sound like a fossil. Tell me, child, what do you like about my country?
Kitty stared at the Sultana blankly. Until today, she had never set foot on Malay soil and didn't know a thing about the country.
Well, I love the people most of all, Your Majesty. So warm and hard-working,
Kitty said, thinking of the half a dozen or so Malay maids that worked at Cluny Park Road. The Dowager Sultana pursed her lips again.
Really? I was not expecting to hear that at all. Most people tell me how much they love our beaches and our satay. So, do you intend to put down some roots here?
Well, if I can find a palace as beautiful as yours, I'd be very tempted.
Why, thank you, but this is no palace. This is just a house.
Kitty's husband, Jack Bing, is one of China's premier industrialists, so they are highly interested in investing in Malaysia.
Well, we do have such a wonderful relationship with China, and I do adore that first lady of yours,
the Dowager Sultana said, picking up a piece of onde onde with her fingers and chewing on it slowly.
Oh, you've met her?
Kitty said excitedly, forgetting royal protocol again.
Why, yes. I gave her an audience at my palace in Perawak. What an accomplished woman, and what a voice.
Now tell me, Oliver, how has your dear grandmama been since I last saw her?
Her health is excellent, ma'am, but I must confess her spirits have been rather low lately. As you know, my great-aunt Sui's passing has affected her greatly.
Kitty, feeling bored, began to zone out on the photo of the Sultana with Michelle Obama. She was trying to identify the designer of Michelle's red dress. Was it Isabel Toledo or Jason Wu? She felt sorry for the First Lady. That poor woman was obligated to only wear American designers. The Sultana continued to speak.
Ah, yes. It was such a beautiful funeral. Did you not enjoy my son's eulogy to Sui?
It was remarkable. I did not know that the Sultan spent a year living at Tyersal Park.
Yes, when he was doing a special course at the National University of Singapore,
Su Yi was kind enough to host him. I'm afraid he found the Malay embassy accommodations to be lacking, and he was much more at home at Tyersal. You do know his great-grandfather was the sultan who originally built it?
Forgive me, ma'am. I had forgotten. No wonder he would feel a kinship to the place. If I might venture to ask, was Su Yi ever conferred with a title?
Kitty's ears suddenly pricked up.
To my knowledge, she wasn't. I believe in the 1970s, the Agong,
the Yang Di Pertuan Agong, or Agong for short, is the monarch of Malaysia. The 9 Malay states each have their own hereditary rulers and royal families, and the Agong is elected from among these rulers every 5 years.
Whoever it was back then, I've lost track, tried to honor her, but she graciously turned it down. She was already Lady Yang, and never even used that title.
Alamak, what would Su Yi need a title for?
There was never any doubt of her position. I mean, she already had Tyersal Park. What more do you need?
That's quite true. Oliver nodded, stirring his tea.
Tell me, Oliver, what is going to happen to that spectacular palace now?
The Sultana asked, her brow furrowing.
Oh, it's anyone's guess. My cousins are entertaining an avalanche of offers. Every day I hear there's someone new coming in with an even higher bid. We're in the billions now.
I'm not surprised at all. If I was younger, I might have considered it as a home in Singapore myself. Of course, it will never be the same without Su Yi. But whoever ends up living there will be tremendously fortunate.
Oliver sighed dramatically. Sadly, though, I don't think that will happen. The house will surely be torn down.
Oh my goodness, how can that be?
The Sultana placed her hand to her chest in shock, showing off her 58-carat blue diamond ring. Kitty's eyes followed the solitaire like a cat, distracted by a shiny toy.
The land is far too valuable. All the developers that have put in bids have ambitious plans for Tyersal Park, and I don't believe that would include the old house.
But what a travesty that would be. Tyersal Park is one of the most elegant estates in Southeast Asia. That rose garden, and the grand salon, such sophistication. Someone needs to rescue it from the greedy developers.
I couldn't agree more, Oliver said.
Kitty listened to them with fascination. This was the first time she had heard anything about this old house.
Well, Oliver, surely you know someone who will want to buy the estate and maintain it to the same standards as Su Yi did? What about that new Chinese duchess, what's her name, who's moving to Singapore to save the chimpanzees? I met her at the funeral.
Kitty looked up from her tea in alarm.
You're referring to the Countess of Palliser?
Oliver said, glancing at Kitty uncomfortably.
Yes, that one. Do you know her? She should buy the house. Then she would become the undisputed queen of Singapore,
the Dowager Sultana declared, popping another sweet coconut ball in her mouth. After their audience with the Sultana, Kitty remained silent during the helicopter ride back to Singapore. As she alighted from the chopper, she turned to Oliver and said,
"This house the Sultana was referring to, how much are we talking about?"
"Kitty, I know you heard what you heard, but the Dowager Sultana lives in a bit of a fantasy land. Colette would never buy Tyersal Park."
"And why not?"
"I know my cousins. They would never sell the house to her."
"Oh, really? You said Colette would never be at your auntie's funeral, and yet there she was. You said Colette wasn't a threat, but then she bumped me off the cover of Tattle. I don't think I can believe anything you say anymore."
"All right, I'll admit I'm not the Oracle of Delphi, but there are some things that even Colette cannot make happen. For one thing, there is no way she can afford that house."
"Really? How much is it?"
"Well, I'm told the highest bid right now is 4 billion, and I know Colette doesn't have that kind of money on her own."
Kitty frowned.
"She doesn't, but she has a trust fund worth 5 billion. She can borrow against that trust if she really wants this house. And something tells me she does.
She wants so desperately to be the Queen of Singapore. Queen of the fucking universe!
Look, Kitty, if it will stop you from losing your mind from this ridiculous rivalry, go ahead, try to buy the house. I'll even go to my cousins with your offer for you. But just so you know, in order for the Youngs to regard your offer as serious, you've got to come in with a bid that wipes everything else off the table clean.
So we offer them $5 billion.
That's not going to work. You have to realize something, Kitty. You are a mainlander who's married to a mogul with a very big but very new fortune. You haven't yet gained the degree of respectability that these people value. If you want to steal Singapore's most prized estate away from its snottiest family, you've got to do it in a big way. You need to shock and awe them with your money.
How much will that take?
$10 billion.
Kitty inhaled deeply.
Okay, then. Offer them $10 billion.
Oliver was taken aback by how quickly she responded. Are you serious? Don't you need to talk to Jack first?
I'll worry about my husband. You worry about getting me that house. And you better get it before that little snake Colette comes around with her tongue out. If she steals this house from under my nose, I will never, ever forgive you. And you know what that means,
Kitty warned as she got into her waiting car. After waving her off, Oliver took out his cell phone and punched a number on his speed dial.
Hello?
A voice answered.
It worked. It bloody worked.
Oliver sighed in relief.
That Kitty girl is going to buy the house?
You better believe it. Auntie Zara, I could kiss your feet.
I can't believe it was that easy,
the Dowager Sultana of Perawak said. The minute you started talking about Tarsal Park, she forgot all about the stupid title.
You were absolutely brilliant.
Was I?
I had no idea you could act like that.
The Dowager Sultana giggled like a schoolgirl.
Oh my goodness, I haven't had this much fun in a long time. That ridiculously formal way you were speaking to me. If I might venture to ask, ha 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 ha, you sounded like you were in a Jane Austen novel.
I was biting my lip to stop from laughing.
And oh, and I have a horrible neck ache now from wearing all those damn necklaces. I thought I was going to be strangled by diamonds.
If you hadn't been dressed like that, Kitty would not have been in such awe of you. She's been spoilt with jewels herself, so we really had to lay on the shock and awe.
Shock and awe indeed. Did you like what I had my guards chant before I made my grand entrance into the room?
Oh my God, I almost peed in my pants. I was thinking, why are they chanting the Singapore Children's Day song?
Hee-hee-hee. Remember when your mummy made you sing it to me one day when you came home from school? You were so proud to sing a song in Malay. Now, did you like my mention of China's first lady?
I did. Very appropriate, Auntie Zara.
I've never even met her.
You deserve an Oscar, Auntie Zara. I owe you big time.
Just send me a jar of those pineapple tarts that your cook makes, and we'll call it even.
Auntie Zara, you're going to get a whole crate of those pineapple tarts.
Alamak, no. Please don't. I'm on a diet. I was so nervous during my performance, I ate too many of those coconut puffs today. I have to force myself to go to my granddaughter's Zumba class in the ballroom now.
Chapter 14. MacRitchie Reservoir, Singapore. It had been a long, hot, mosquito-ridden hike, and as Carlton pounded his way up another sloping hill, he wondered what the hell he had been thinking when he suggested this plan to Scheherazade. His shirt was drenched in sweat, and he was certain that no amount of Serge Latin's cologne could mask how he smelt at this point. He turned around to check on Scheherazade and saw that she was crouched on the ground, staring at something. At a discreet distance, three of her bodyguards in jogging clothes stood watching them.
Look, it's a monitor lizard,
she pointed. He's a pretty big fella, Carlton said, as he caught sight of the 3-foot-long reptile resting under a clump of bushes.
It's a she, I believe,
Scheherazade corrected.
We had quite a big menagerie of pets when I was growing up. Reptiles were my thing.
This was in Surrey?
Actually, this was when we were in Bali. My family lived there for about 3 years when I was a little girl. I was a bit of a wild child then, going barefoot everywhere around the island.
That explains why you're not even breaking a sweat right now, Carlton said, trying his best not to stare too hard at her goddess-like physique shown off to perfection in her mesh-paneled leggings and stretch-knit sports bra.
You know, it's funny. I never sweat. Ever. I'm told that Queen Elizabeth doesn't either.
Well, you're in good company, Carlton remarked, as they finally arrived at the Treetop Walk, a 250-meter suspension bridge that stretches from Bukit Pierce to Bukit Kalang, the two highest points of the preserve. As they traversed the narrow bridge, it began to sway slightly, but then the view opened up and suddenly it felt as though they were floating above the trees. They reached the middle of the bridge and stood in silence for a while, taking in the remarkable view. The tropical forest canopy stretched all around them as far as the eye could see, and the sounds of cackling birds echoed through the breeze.
Unbelievable! Thanks for bringing me here, Scheherazade said.
It doesn't feel like we're in Singapore anymore, does it?
Sure doesn't. This is the first place I've been to in a long while that's reminded me of my childhood. I mean, it's quite a relief to see that all this nature still exists here.
Scheherazade stared at the calm reservoir in the distance, the water glinting in the late afternoon sun.
Has the island changed that much? I only started coming here about 5 years ago.
Carlton, you can't even imagine. Every time I'm back, I hardly recognize it anymore. So much of the old atmosphere has just been wiped clean.
I guess that's why you like living in Paris?
Partly. Paris is great because every street you walk down is like an unfolding novel. I actually love it because even though there's history everywhere, it's not my history. Does that make any sense?
Sure. Shanghai is my hometown, but it doesn't feel like home anymore. Whenever I'm back, it feels I can never escape my past. Everyone remembers everything about you. Your family history. Your mistakes. Carlton said, his face clouding for a moment before he turned back to her. But that's not what you meant, was it?
Not really. For me, Paris is like neutral territory because it's neither Singapore nor England. You know, even though I was born in Singapore and lived here until I was 10, I never felt like I truly belonged. Maybe it was because of how I looked. My hair was almost blonde back then. It seemed like most people just assumed I was Ang Mo.
And my mom inadvertently reinforced this by pretty much raising me as though I was British. Aside from my Chinese cousins, everyone else we knew was part of the British set. I don't blame her at all. She felt awfully homesick and was overwhelmed at first by my father's family. So we sort of existed in this English expat bubble, and for the first 10 years of my life, I went along thinking of myself as completely English.
Carlton gave her a knowing smile.
Bit of a shock when you actually got to England, wasn't it?
Uh-huh.
When we finally moved to Surrey, I realized that the English didn't really see me as I saw myself. I was this exotic, half-Chinese girl to them. So I felt like I was just absolutely screwed on both ends. I wasn't Singaporean enough, but neither was I English enough. Carlton nodded in agreement.
I was sent away to school in England for most of my life, and now I can't really relate to the Chinese back home. In Shanghai, I'm seen as too westernized. Here in Singapore, I'm seen as an uncivilized mainlander. But in London, even though I'm clearly an outsider, I feel like I can just be myself, and no one's judging my every move. I guess that's what Paris does for you. You feel liberated.
Exactly, Scheherazade said, flashing Carlton a smile so alluring he had to stop himself from staring.
A group of men entered the bridge from the other end, and as they came closer, Scheherazade couldn't help but notice that they all looked Italian and were impeccably dressed in white jackets and bow ties. "Looks like we're being joined by extras from a Fellini movie," Scheherazade joked.
"Yes, La Dolce Vita, and right on time," Carlton said.
The men began setting up an elaborate bar right in front of them, taking out a mixture of spirits, cocktail implements, and glassware.
"Did you arrange this?"
Scheherazade asked, wide-eyed.
"Well, I couldn't take you on a sweltering sunset hike and not provide you with sunset drinks."
Three of the men whipped out a bass, a saxophone, and a small drum set, and began to play a Miles Davis tune.
"Can I offer you a Negroni, signora?" the bartender said, handing Scheherazade a highball glass filled with Campari, gin and red vermouth over ice, with an orange peel elaborately curled over the rim.
"Grazie, mille,"
Scheherazade replied.
"Salute,"
Carlton said, clicking her glass with his Negroni.
"How in the world did you know this was my favorite drink?"
Scheherazade asked as she sipped her aperitif.
I might have done some Instagram stalking.
But my Instagram account is locked.
I might have been on Nick's Instagram," Carlton confessed.
Scheherazade laughed, utterly charmed. Carlton looked in her eyes and then glanced over her shoulder at her security guards loitering at the end of the bridge.
"Would it be crazy if I kissed you? I mean, would your guards have me on the ground in under 2 seconds?
"It would be crazy if you didn't," Scheherazade said, leaning in to kiss him. After a long, lingering kiss, the two of them stood wrapped in each other's arms in the middle of the bridge, watching as the setting sun glimmered over the treetops, casting a glow of flaming amber over the horizon. It was almost 7:30 by the time Carlton pulled up to the driveway of Scheherazade's home. He didn't want to drop her off just yet, and wished he could whisk her off to dinner and spend the whole evening with her. But his sense of decorum took over, and he wanted her to set the pace of how things should go. Scheherazade smiled at him, and it was obvious that she didn't want their date to end just yet either.
"Why don't you come up? My parents usually have drinks around this time."
"Are you sure? I wouldn't want to intrude."
"Not at all.
I think they'd like to meet you properly.
They've been rather curious about you."
"Well, if you don't think I'm unpresentable right now in my soiled hiking gear..."
"Oh, you're fine. It's all very casual."
Carlton handed off the keys to his vintage 1975 Toyota Land Cruiser to the valet in the driveway, and they strode through the elegant lobby of the sleek glass tower. For a family that arguably controlled the majority of the country's GDP, the Shangs lived modestly when they were in Singapore. Alfred had long ago divested all of his landed properties on the island, but he had built this exceedingly discreet private apartment tower on Grange Road, where each of his children had been given several floors.
"Good evening, Miss Shang,"
the guards at the reception desk said in unison. One of them escorted them to the elevators, reaching inside to enter a security code into a keypad. They zoomed up to the penthouse, and when the doors opened, Carlton could hear the murmur of voices just off the entrance foyer. The two of them strolled into a circular, atrium-like sunken living room, and then Carlton stopped dead in his tracks. Standing in the middle of the room, in a shimmering peacock blue cocktail dress, was his ex-girlfriend, Colette. He had not spoken to or seen her in almost 2 years, not since he discovered that she was responsible for poisoning Rachel.
"Oh, hello. Looks like we have more guests than I thought,"
Scheherazade said.
Her father turned to them and said, "Ah, at last, the prodigal daughter returns. Scheherazade, come meet Lucien and Colette, the Earl and Countess of Palliser."
Scheherazade strode over to greet them, and then she proceeded to introduce Carlton to everyone. Still in shock, Carlton shook hands numbly with Leonard and India Shang, who were dressed to the nines
and gave Carlton's hiking attire a rather disapproving once-over. Then the unavoidable moment came when he was face to face with Lucien and Colette. She looked different. Her hair was pulled into an elegant ballerina's knot at the nape of her neck, and she wore far less makeup than he remembered. But he was surprised at how all his anger toward her suddenly came flooding back. The last time they had seen each other, he had accused her of trying to poison his sister. "Hello, Carlton," Colette said, perfectly composed. "Colette," Carlton murmured back, trying valiantly to stay calm.
"Oh, you two know each other?"
India Shang said in surprise.
"But of course. You lived in Shanghai for a period."
"For a period," Colette said.
"Well then, you must stay for dinner,"
India insisted.
"Yes, do stay," Colette said sweetly.
Carlton forced a smile at his hostess. "It would be a pleasure to join you for dinner, Mrs. Shang." Soon, they were all seated around the table in a dining room, enjoying a 12-course tasting menu prepared by Marcus Sim, the Shang's personal chef. Carlton looked around at the exquisite minimalist paintings surrounding them and commented,
"Are these works by Agnes Martin?"
"Indeed they are,"
Leonard Shang replied, impressed that Carlton recognized the artist.
"Do you collect?"
India asked.
"Not really, no,"
Carlton replied.
"Carlton collects cars,"
Colette said, with a gleam in her eye.
"Oh, really? What sort? I'm restoring an MG midget at the moment,"
Lucien said.
"I do love MGs, but I actually have a car import business in China. We specialize in exotics like McLarens, Bugattis, and Koenigseggs."
"My goodness, those are awfully fast cars, aren't they?"
India commented.
"They are incredibly engineered automobiles. Works of art, really. And yes, they are built for speed,"
Carlton answered calmly.
"Carlton likes to go very fast. He used to race."
Colette took a bite of a grilled octopus and gave him an innocent look across the table. Scheherazade glanced at Carlton, noticing the tension on his face.
"Oh dear, have you ever been in an accident?"
India asked, making up her mind right then that Scheherazade should never ride in this young man's car again.
"Actually, I have," Carlton replied.
"What happened? Hope you didn't wreck one of those million-dollar sports cars," Lucien laughed.
"It was a very unfortunate accident, but it taught me to be extremely careful." "I don't race anymore,"
Carlton said.
"I'm glad you're okay," Scheherazade said with a little smile.
"Well,"
Colette interjected with a glint in her eye,
"when you kill one girl and paralyze another from the waist down, it's probably best not to, isn't it?"
While Leonard Shang choked on his Chardonnay and his wife rose as if she had just been turned into a pillar of salt, Colette flashed a smile at Carlton. It was a smile he knew only too well, and at that moment he realized that Colette Bing might call herself the Countess of Palliser these days, but she hadn't changed one fucking bit. Chapter 15. The Peak, Hong Kong. Chloe made the call from her bathroom with the shower turned on full blast.
"Dad, you said to call, you know, if Mum was ever acting weird again?"
Charlie felt his gut tighten.
"What happened? Are you and Delphine okay?"
"We're fine, but maybe you should come over."
Charlie looked at his watch. It was just past 11 at night. "I'm leaving my office right this second. Be there in 15 minutes. Do me a favor, honey. Stay with your mother?"
Okay.
Charlie could hear the fear in her voice. He raced to the house in his Porsche 911, the sports car careening dangerously along the hairpin curves and steep hills all the way up to the peak. He speed-dialed Isabel's lead security officer, Johnny Fung, from his Bluetooth, but it went straight to voicemail. All the while,
His heart was beating a mile a minute as he dreaded what he would find when he arrived at the house. Isabel had been doing so well. Was this really another breakdown, or did she stop taking her meds again? A few blocks from the house, Charlie got caught in a traffic jam as cars waited bumper to bumper. He leaned on his horn anxiously and then decided, fuck it, he would cut onto the oncoming traffic lane. He raced past the line of cars and discovered that they were all trying to go to the same place, Isabel's house. There was a cluster of people in front of the gates as Charlie pulled up. He jumped out of the car and approached the security guards stationed by the gate.
What the hell is happening?
Private party,
one of the guards said in Cantonese. Party? Tonight? I'm going in.
Wait a second. Are you on the list? What's your name?
The baby-faced guard asked, holding an iPad with a list of names glowing on the screen.
My name? Jesus, get out of my face! Charlie seethed, pushing past him and running down the driveway.
Just as he reached the porte cochere of the house, three bodyguards in black suits suddenly appeared out of nowhere and jumped on top of him.
Got the crusher!
One of the guards said into his earpiece as he pinned Charlie's face to the ground.
Get off me! This is my house!
Charlie grunted as one of the guards held him in a knee lock.
Yeah, right,
the guards laughed mockingly.
Get Mr. Fung out here now. I'm Charlie Wu, and this is my house. I sign all your paychecks.
At the mention of their boss's name, one of the guards started talking urgently into his earpiece. Moments later, the head of security came out of the house and began shouting,
That's Mr. Wu! Get off him, you fucking morons!
Charlie got up from the ground and brushed the dirt off his face.
Johnny, what the fuck is going on here? Why aren't you picking up your phone?
Sorry, I was inside, and it's very loud in there, Johnny apologized. Mrs. Wu decided to have the party just this afternoon. It's a benefit for the earthquake victims in Yunnan province.
You've got to be fucking kidding me,
Charlie muttered as he entered the house. There were at least 50 people crowded in the foyer, and a man suddenly grabbed him from behind and gave him a full-on bear hug.
Charlie, you're here!
It was Pascal Pang, his face inexplicably powdered white with rouge on his cheeks.
I was just telling Tilda that I've never seen such a pleasant divorce as you and Isabel had. Look, he even comes to her parties. My ex-wives won't even take my calls. Ha, ha, ha.
Charlie was bewildered as a pale, thin woman with uniquely androgynous features, dressed in a silver jumpsuit, smiled at him sweetly.
So, you're Charlie. Astrid's told me so much about you,
she said in a lilting British accent.
Has she?
Excuse me. I just need to find someone. Charlie squeezed through the crowded foyer and into the sprawling formal room, which had been utterly transformed into a dark, funereal space. All of Isabel's pretty French furniture had been covered in black fabric, and even the walls were draped in black. Guests sat at little black bistro tables lit with red votive candles, and a woman dressed in a long, deep red velvet dress lay on top of the grand piano with a microphone in her hand. As the pianist tickled the keys, she sang in a deep, throaty voice.
Falling in love again. Never wanted to. What am I to do? I can't help it.
Charlie spotted Isabel at one of the front tables, dressed in a man's tuxedo with her hair slicked back, sitting on the lap of a male model who looked to be no older than 25. Chloe and Delphine stood behind her, dressed in matching outfits of black vests, black shorts with garter belts, and black bowler hats, looking extremely uncomfortable. Chloe's face lit up in relief the moment she saw her father. Charlie marched up to Isabel's table and demanded, Can we talk?
Shh! Uta Lempa singing,
Isabel said, waving him off. We really need to talk, now. Charlie said, as calmly as possible, grabbing her arm and leading her to the back of the room.
What is your problem? We have one of the greatest chanteuses in the world right here, and you're interrupting.
Isabel's breath reeked of vodka, and Charlie looked into her eyes, trying to figure out if she was just drunk or having a manic episode.
Isabel, it's Thursday night. Why are you hosting a party for 200 people right now? And what on earth did you make the girls put on?
Don't you get it? This is the Weimar Republic. It's 1931 Berlin, and we're at the Kit Kat Club. Chloe and Delphine are both dressed like Sally Bowles.
Sighing deeply, he said, I'm going to take them home with me right now. It's past midnight on a school night, and they can hardly keep their eyes open.
What are you talking about? The girls are having the time of their lives. I especially invited Hao Yunxiang to the party because Chloe's got a crush on him.
Isabel gestured to the strapping male model whose lap she had been keeping warm.
You're just jealous, aren't you? Don't worry. I think you've got a bigger cock.
At that moment, Charlie knew she was out of her mind. Isabel could do some outrageous things, but she was never profane. I'm not jealous, he began calmly.
Well then, stop spoiling all the fun for the rest of us,
Isabel declared, going back to her chair. She straddled her male model this time and began swaying to the music. It was obvious to Charlie that Isabel was in the midst of a manic high, and sooner or later she was going to come crashing down, and who knows what she would do. It was useless to argue with her like this. He grabbed Chloe and Delphine by their hands and marched them toward the exit. At the front door, he whispered to Johnny Feng, You don't let Isabel out of your sight. You hear me? And don't let her leave the house until I come back tomorrow morning with her doctors.
Of course,
the head of security nodded.
At 3 a.m., Charlie was woken up by a phone call. Seeing it was Isabel, he rolled over on his back with a sigh and answered.
Where are my girls?
Isabel said, sounding preternaturally calm.
They're here with me, fast asleep.
Why did you drag them off like that?
I didn't drag them off. They were only too happy to leave the freak show and come home with me.
You know, you deprived them of seeing Uta's full performance. She sang three encores.
She sang, Non je ne regrette rien.
And I wanted Chloe to meet Tilda Swinton. When will she ever get a chance like this again?
I'm sorry, Isabel. I'm sorry Chloe didn't get a chance to meet Tilda. But apparently she's friends with Astrid, so maybe she'll have another chance.
I don't give a flying fuck about Astrid! Don't you see that there are people suffering in the world? Do you know we raised $2 million tonight for the earthquake victims? Think of all the children we are helping.
Charlie gave an exasperated laugh. He knew it was pointless to argue with her when she was having one of these episodes, but he couldn't help himself. You could start with your own children.
So you think I'm a bad mother?
Isabel said, suddenly sounding very sad. I don't think that. I think you're a wonderful mother. But you're just having a bad night.
I am not having a bad night. I am having a fantabulous evening. I am a charity fundraiser par extraordinaire, and I am trying to help out children.
Isabel began to sing in a slow, soulful voice.
I believe the children are our future. Teach them well and let them lead the way.
Izzy, it's 3 in the morning. Can we stop with the Whitney Houston?
Charlie said wearily.
I'll never stop. Those bastards crushed Whitney's spirit, but they will never crush mine. Do you hear me?
Izzy, I'm going to sleep now. I will see you tomorrow morning, first thing. I'll bring the girls home before school so they can change into their uniforms.
Don't you dare hang up on me, Charlie Wu!
Isabel demanded. But it was too late. Charlie had hung up. He had hung up on her in the way that he never used to. Isabel's mind went into a roller coaster dip as she stared out the window onto the crashing waves of the ocean. Unbeknownst to Charlie, she had been sitting in the bedroom of his new house in Shekou during the entire call.
Foiling her security crew, she had swapped outfits with Ute Lempar after her second encore and slipped unnoticed out of her own party in a deep red velvet dress. She had taken the first car in the valet line and driven in a manic rage all the way to Charlie's house. She had punched in the code she remembered. 110011. And now she was wandering through the empty Tom Kundig-designed house, spiraling into greater and greater rage.
So this is what it's going to be like now. This is how it is now that you have your new life in this perfect glass house by the sea. This boring, bourgeois, architectural digest fantasy with all your boring mid-century furniture and that boring little decorative object you wake up next to every morning. Because that's what she is. That Astrid Leong and her sham aesthetics. Just because she wears a Lexus Mobile to lunch, she thinks she's hot shit. She thinks she's an original. She's nothing but a perfectly bred, decorative doll with no substance and no grit. Everyone thinks she's so exquisite and so elegant, but I know the truth. I know what kind of woman she really is. Isabel leaned against the dining table, took out her cell phone, and swiped around the screen furiously until she found what she was looking for. It was a video clip she had saved in a locked folder. It was the video of Charlie and Astrid making love. And as she played the video, the sound of their moans echoed through the vast, empty house.
Look at her. She's no better than a whore. Look at the way she straddles him, commanding his invading prick like she's riding one of her thoroughbreds. This isn't a woman who will just settle for being friends with Chloe and Delphine. This is a woman who wants it all. And because of all her money, she thinks she can buy whatever she wants. She bought Charlie, and now she wants to buy my children and buy their love and turn them into little carbon copies of herself with long ballerina necks and perfect couture outfits. She wants to sit in this perfect house and look out at the perfect view of the sea with my daughters, and stroke their hair in the golden sunlight, and twirl them around the garden like they are all in some goddamn Terrence Malick movie, and convince them that this is the only life they should ever want.
"You'll always be welcome here," she says.
"Like hell I will." The day after her wedding, she's going to shut me out forever.
I just know it.
She thinks she's going to erase me from their lives. But I will never let this happen. Never, never, never.
With trembling fingers, Isabel jammed out a message on the gossip columnist Honey Chai's WeChat message board.
Astrid Leong has stolen my life. She is a cheating, husband-stealing whore. Just look at her whoring herself in this video. She is nothing but a vapid rich girl, an heiress to an evil fortune that destroys our planet. I curse her. I curse Charlie Wu. I curse this house built on deceit and sin. For the rest of eternity, there will never ever be any peace in this house.
Isabel attached the video clip and hit post, as the video streamed out to millions of WeChat users all over the world. Then, she climbed up on the wooden Nakashima dining table, as if it was a giant surfboard, took off her long velvet gown, rolled it into a tight long rope, and threw one end around the Lindsay Adelman chandelier. She fastened the other end taut over the white tender part of her neck, and inched the edge of the table slowly, step by step, gazing out the window at the moonlit sea. And then she jumped. Chapter 16.
Tyersal Park, Singapore. It was an epic fail, a disaster of titanic proportions. Carlton sighed over the phone to his sister as he recounted his date with Scheherazade.
I'm so sorry, Carlton. It sounds traumatic, Rachel said. So what happened after Colette dropped her bombshell?
Well, it basically killed the dinner for everyone. Scheherazade didn't eat a thing after that, and I bolted right after dessert was served. It became apparent to me that Scheherazade's parents were going to file a restraining order against me if I stuck around 1 minute longer.
I'm sure it wasn't that bad.
No, actually, it probably got worse. Everyone went into the drawing room for drinks and coffee, and I just know Colette was itching to get into all the details of exactly what happened in London. I'm sure she went on a no-holds-barred campaign to tell the Shangs what a murderous monster I am. Scheherazade walked me down to my car, and I tried to tell her the whole story, but it just all came out wrong. I was rushing and nervous, and I think she was too in shock to process anything.
It's a lot of story for a first date, Carlton. Give her a little time to recover, Rachel said gently.
She'll have all the time in the world. I heard she left for Paris first thing this morning. Game over.
It's not game over. Maybe her leaving had nothing to do with you.
Uh-uh. I don't think so. She hasn't responded to any of my texts in the past 24 hours.
Rachel rolled her eyes. Jesus, you millennials! If you really want to win her back, fly to Paris, send her 1,000 roses, take her to dinner at some romantic rooftop in the Marais. Just do something other than text her.
It's not so simple. She's surrounded by bodyguards 24/7. If she's not going to respond to my texts, I don't want to be some creepy stalker who shows up at her doorstep.
Carlton, even if you tried, you would never come across as a creepy stalker. Scheherazade's obviously freaked out because she's been fed a line of bullshit from Colette. So you need to show her who you really are. She's waiting for you to do that, don't you see?
I think she's back in Paris, living her life, probably dating some French count with 3-week-old stubble by now. Rachel sighed.
You know what it is, Carlton? You're just spoiled. You had the fortune, or maybe the misfortune, of being born good-looking, and girls have been throwing themselves at you all your life. You've never had to lift a finger. Scheherazade is the first girl who's challenging you, who's making you work for it. You've met your match. So are you gonna step up?
Carlton was quiet for a moment.
So what's my next move, Rachel? You need to figure that out. I'm not going to give you a cheat sheet. You need to win her back with a wildly romantic gesture. Look, I need to go. There's a potential buyer coming to tour Tyersal Park this morning, and you don't want to know who it is.
Why not? Carlton asked.
Because it's Jack Bing.
Bollocks! You're pulling my leg!
I wish I was. He's offering an insane amount of money for the house.
Bloody hell. Between Colette and her father, the Bings are clearly out for blood in Singapore. Don't sell it to him.
Rachel sighed. I wish it were up to me. Nick and I are actually trying to avoid him, and I think I hear people arriving.
Okay. Call me later.
Jack Bing stood in the middle of the Andalusian cloister, puffing away on his cigar as he stared at the ornately carved columns.
This is incredible. I've never seen a house like this in my whole life, he said in Mandarin.
I love this inner courtyard. We can take out this reflecting pool and put in a real swimming pool, Kitty suggested in English.
Felicity, Victoria, and Alex winced, but said nothing. Oliver stepped in diplomatically.
Kitty, this reflecting pool was brought over tile by tile from Cordoba, Spain. Do you see these blue and coral Moorish tiles lining the pool? They're extraordinarily rare, from the 13th century.
Oh, I had no idea. Of course we must keep them then, Kitty said.
Jack stared at the lotus-shaped rose quartz in the middle of the fountain that was bubbling a slow, hypnotic trickle of water.
No, we mustn't change a thing.
This house may not be as grand as our place in Shanghai, but it has amazing feng shui. I can feel the qi flowing through everywhere. No wonder your family prospered here, Jack told the assembled ladies. The young sisters nodded politely, as none of them spoke Mandarin and only understood about 30% of what he said. Jack looked at the three frumpily dressed sisters, thinking to himself, only women who grew up in a place like this can get away with looking like that. And they can't even speak a word of Mandarin. They are like dodo birds, a useless species. No wonder they are losing their house. The group proceeded through the arcade into the library. Jack looked around at all the old books lining the double-height bookcases and the sleek Indian rosewood desk. I love this kind of furniture. Art deco, isn't it?
Actually, this was Sir James's library, and he had all the furniture custom designed by Pierre Jeanneret in the late 1940s, Oliver informed him.
Well, it reminds me a bit of the old Shanghai clubs where my grandfather used to play, Jack remarked. Turning to the ladies, he said, my grandfather worked in a water boiler factory, but he was also a trumpet player. Every night, for extra money, he would play in a jazz band that performed in all of the clubs frequented by Westerners. When I was a little boy, it was my duty to shine his trumpet for him every night. I would spit and spit at the trumpet to clean it, in order to make the polish go farther.
Felicity backed away nervously, afraid that he might actually perform one of his spitting demonstrations near her.
How much for the furniture? Jack asked.
Which pieces do you have in mind? Some of them are things that we could never part with, Victoria said in the rudimentary Mandarin she used with her servants. Oliver, how do you say heirloom in Mandarin?
Ah, that's chuanjiabao, Oliver told her. Oh, I love the tables, the chairs.
This purple and blue rug,
especially.
Jack pointed at the floor.
Felicity stared down at the purple silk rug and a story her Aunt Rosemary Sien had once told her suddenly came flooding back.
You know, your mother once stared a Japanese general in the eye and dared him to shoot her. It happened right here in this library, where Su Yi was hosting a card party for some high-ranking officers. They were always forcing her to do things like this during the occupation, host these horrible debauched parties for them. My husband, your uncle Sai Tae, had just been arrested for some ridiculous offense, and when the general lost a game of gin rummy to your mother, she demanded that in return he free Sai Tae. Of course, the general was outraged by her boldness and immediately took out his pistol and held it to her temple. I was sitting right next to her, and I thought she was a gone case. Su Yi remained completely calm and said in that imperious way of hers, General, you are going to ruin Rosemary's beautiful Cheongsam if you shoot me right now. My brains will be all over it, not to mention this beautiful Art Deco carpet from Paris. Do you know how much this carpet is worth? It's designed by a very famous French artist named Christian Berard, and would make such a beautiful present for your wife, if only it wasn't stained with my blood. Now, you wouldn't want to disappoint your wife, would you? The general was silent for a moment, but then he burst into laughter. And then he put down his gun, took the rug with him, and the next day, they released my husband from prison. Sai Tae would never forget what Su Yi did for him. Hiya, there are so many stories I can tell you about the war years, but Su Yi wouldn't want me to. But you know, she saved the lives of so many people, and most of them didn't even realize she was the one responsible. She wanted it that way. After the war was over, we heard that the general was executed for war crimes during the war tribunals in Manila. One day,
your mother called me up and said,
"You'll never guess what just arrived in a long box. That purple Art Deco rug that the general took back to Japan." I suppose his wife never approved of it.